You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Welcome, everybody.
Welcome.
Welcome to anybody who's gone through the snow belt. I think it's all around the east, the south, the north, the west. And I think we're right in the middle of no snow, but be assured there is lots of it out there. Pardon me?
In the banana belt.
In the banana belt, yes. Toronto, the banana belt. At this time, I would like to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, and that the lands were previously occupied by the Seneca, Huron, Wendat First Nations. Welcome. We have another special guest speaker today, which Deb will properly introduce a little further into the service. Greta and Scott are on the last leg of their holiday, coming back from the true banana belt of Florida, hopefully rested, maybe a little bit more tanned than normal. I doubt it, because neither one of them sort of stays in one spot for very long. Perpetual motion. So it should be interesting next week to hear some of how things went, because Greta was also doing a number of speaking engagements. Also wanted to highlight that Greta did a extensive interview with Toronto Life. So she is front cover of the Toronto Life. So if you want to see a little bit more of, I have not seen it, but here we are. No, she's not the front cover, but there's a major expose on Greta. So, and I also like to thank Dale for her gift of music in Scott's absence. So, thanks again, Dale. Well, now that we've sort of raised the energy level and our blood's flowing and everyone's a lot more smiles on the faces, it's great to see. The Truth and Reconciliation Call to Action. Each week, in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationships we have with our First Nations sisters and brothers, we read one of the 94 recommendations sent to all levels of government by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We expect to complete these readings in June of 2017. Recommendation number 12. We call upon the federal, provincial, territorial, and Aboriginal governments to develop culturally appropriate early childhood education programs for Aboriginal families.
Thank you, Randy. Good morning. This part of the service is intended to provide an opportunity to turn our hearts and our minds towards why we come. I mean, we come to sing and we come to hug and see each other, but we come together because we have common values and common purpose and a common foundation. So we talk every week about the three G's, right? Grounded, guided, growing. And that actually comes out of our Vision Works document. So the idea that we're grounded, not necessarily in a faith tradition or in biblical documents or the Quran, but we're grounded in our understanding of the interconnectedness of all of life and what that means for our choices as we go through every single day. We try to live in right relationship with ourselves, first of all, and with others and with the planet. Rob and I attended a National Geographic on Tuesday night, and it is it is heartbreaking what we are doing to the planet, and also inspiring to see what people are doing to make it better. So we're grounded. Someone said to me this morning, please don't cry when you get up there. I said, I can't promise anything. We're guided by love. We ask ourselves, what would love do now? And then we commit to growing, and we grow from diverse sources of wisdom, including the people in this very room. So, I mean, we tend to rush around through the week, and even on a Sunday morning, you know, we come in and we're saying hello to people, and then there's music and singing, and then there's the frenzy of the hug fest in the middle. Scott was like, wow. I know. But there needs to be balance too, right? And so that's what this next few minutes is about, is a chance for silence, a chance to sort of focus in on the grounding portion of that. So to stop and ask yourself, what is it that grounds you? You know, are you feeling grounded these days, or are you feeling in a constant state of frenzy and anxiety? So for those of you who do yoga or meditation, the next 60 seconds is going to be, you've probably already started without me, that's fine. For those of you for whom this is not your thing, you can, you know, make your Christmas list mentally in your, or, you know, your grocery list or something. That's fine. So you have 60 seconds of silence, 1 minute out of the week for silence. So I extend the invitation to just take a breath. I'll actually take a few breaths during the 60 seconds. And you can close your eyes and just maybe tune into the beating of your heart or your breath. 60 seconds, and I've got a stopwatch. Enjoy. I hope you enjoyed that, and we may be doing more of that in the services in the future, just to give that moment for listening.
Our reading today is Optimism is a Political Act by Alex Steffen. Entrenched interests use despair, confusion, and apathy to prevent change. They encourage modes of thinking which leads us to believe that problems are insolvable, that nothing can be done, that nothing we can matter, that the issue is too complex to present even the opportunity for change. It is a long-standing political act to sow the seeds of mistrust between those you would rule over. As Machiavelli said, tyrants do not care if they are hated, so as long as those under them do not love one another. Cynicism is often seen as a rebellious act in Western popular culture. But in reality, cynicism in average people is the attitude exactly most likely to conform to the desires of the powerful. Cynicism is obedience. Optimism, by contrast, especially optimism which is neither foolish nor silent, can be revolutionary. Where no one believes in a better future, despair is a logical choice, and people in despair almost never change anything. Where no one believes a better solution is possible, those benefiting from the continuation of the problem are safe. Where no one believes in the possibility of action, apathy becomes an insurmountable obstacle to reform. But introduce intelligent reasons for believing that action is possible, that better solutions are available, and that a better future can be built, and you unleash the power of people to act out of their highest principles. Shared belief in a better future is the strongest glue there is. It creates the opportunity for us to love one another, and love is an explosive force in politics. Great movements for social change always begin with statements of great optimism. Offered for the journey.
It is my pleasure. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is for me to introduce our guest speaker this morning, Scott Campbell. Many of you will remember him. He's been here before. But Scott and I have been friends and colleagues first and then friends, since 1999. I was just sitting there figuring out, how long has it been? 1999. So a long time, and I've been through the ups and downs of life together and have been good friends for a long time. So I'm very pleased that he's here. He has moved to Warkworth now with his lovely wife, and so I don't see him as much. So I was thinking we should invite you maybe once every couple of weeks to come and speak. Yeah, that's good, yeah. So here's his formal bio. He's a highly successful speaker. He's a consultant. He's an author. In the last 20 years, he's consulted with companies from many Fortune 500 companies. He's a former instructor in the Schulich School Business Executive Education Center. He possesses a certificate in strategic decision making and risk management from Stanford University. A certificate in designing solutions for innovation and strategy from Weatherhead School of Management. He holds a Master of Divinity from Tyndale College. He has spoken all over the world, of course, in Canada and the United States as well. And he is the author of several books, including his most recent, which is called Mind Games, 7 Tricks Your Brain Plays When Making Decisions. And best of all, Scott is a friend of West Hill and has shared his stories and his ideas with us on a number of occasions. So please join me in welcoming Scott Campbell back with us. Scott has asked that for the focused moment that we show you a video instead, and many of you will know this. It's by Carl Sagan. He's the narrator, and it's The Pale Blue Dot. So enjoy. This is your focused moment.
That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering. Thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines. Every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization. Every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. The earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors, so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. In our obscurity, in all this vastness, there is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves. The Earth is the only world known so far to harbor life. There is nowhere else, at least in the near future, to which our species could migrate. Visit? Yes. Settle? Not yet. Like it or not, for the moment, the Earth is where we make our stand. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
Well, it is so good to be back with you. It's actually been a little while, I think, since I've spoken here, and I started thinking, like, what did I say the last time that offended people so much that they wouldn't have me back? So I was quite relieved when I got an email from John saying, hey, can you come and speak again while Greta's away? And it really is good to be back with you. You know, Deb mentioned the hugginess thing. Yeah, every time I come here, it's more huggy, which I think is such a great thing. I mean, that speaks well to the warm bonds that you have with each other, and I feel very hugged. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. When Debbie reads that bio, I asked her before the service, don't read it, don't read it. You know, you don't need to. And every time I hear that read, I think, man, I'm good. And then I think, I'm glad my mom wrote my bio. the stuff that makes me really proud of the work that I do now, you're going to hear just a little bit of it during my talk. It's not the past stuff, it's the future opportunities. And that's really going to be my focus for today, is things that we can celebrate and be excited about, ways that the world is getting better and better all the time. And I hope by the end of this to have convinced you that it is, in a lot of very significant ways, actually getting better all the time. Now, as a professional speaker, I usually have my own remote, which I'm very subtly using, and my remote wouldn't work here this morning. So Peter is my remote, so you're going to see me going like this, and that's my clicking of the remote button. And I appreciate that, Peter, that we're going to work together on this. Many of us, I think, including me, have felt rather heavy in the last 10 days with a lot of the events that have been taking place in the world. Particularly, of course, our attention has been on Paris and the terrorist acts there, terrorist acts in Beirut, terrorist acts in Nigeria, and even more recently now in Mali as well. And it is understandable that we feel heavy-hearted, and it is easy for us to give in to feelings of despair. So I'm going to tell you, in contrast, ways that the world is getting better and better, because most of the time, this is how we feel about the world.
Police pepper spray.
Vicious cartels.
Caustic cruise lines.
Societal decay. 65 dead.
Tsunami warning.
Cyber attacks.
Drug war.
Mass destruction.
Tornado.
Recession.
Default.
Doomsday.
Egypt.
Syria.
Crisis.
Death.
Disaster.
Oh my God.
Oh my God, you know, that's usually how we feel about things. So, in contrast, the title for my talk today is actually, I have to admit, it's getting better. And I'm going to talk about, in fact, 7 ways that the world is getting better all the time. For a long time, it's been getting better and better. Now, when you talk this way, and I think by nature I'm an optimist, and I tend to naturally believe that things are always better in the future. And when you talk as an optimist, it's very common that the people I'm talking to, I can tell the look in their eyes is kind of, what an idiot. Or, what are you smoking? And so I think I'm coming into a situation often where it's hard to get people to really believe that, in fact, in the big scale of things, I genuinely believe the world is getting better and better, in spite of all that we see. So why is it that so much of the time it is easy to give way to pessimism? And now, we did have a moment of optimism. I suspect that many of you, when you saw the results of this, you felt the world is getting better finally. Now, some of you, I hope I just didn't offend politically, but I know it seemed to be there was a wide sigh of relief throughout our nation, but I'm not referring to that. In fact, most of the time, we often think the end is right around the corner. And it's coming closer all the time. Well, there are a couple of reasons I just want to mention at the start as to why I think much of the time we feel gloomy about the future and we feel pessimistic. You know, every single generation for hundreds of years has felt that the next generation is going to be a disaster, that things are going to be worse. So why is that? Well, one reason is because one of the ways that our brains are wired is for what psychologists refer to as a negativity bias. We are more sensitive to negative events than positive events. And we often are fascinated by negative events. If any of you are Seinfeld fans, there's a wonderful episode where Kramer has his portrait painted, and it's rather ugly. But there's this rich couple that is thinking of buying this portrait, and the husband says, "It's hideous, but I can't look away." And, you know, that's the reason why, in spite of, you know, we're always telling people, don't rubberneck when you go past an accident, and of course everybody's still like, oh, what's over there? We are fascinated by negativity. Now, I got to admit, I am as well. That's why I'm a fan of this show, and I love The Walking Dead, to be honest. And when you look at novels about the future, how many of them portray a wonderful future? You know, they're usually very depressing, apocalyptic, you know, the world has come to an end, and everybody's just trying barely to survive. Our negativity bias shows up in many ways, and so we tend not to see, or we discount the importance of positive things. There's a second reason, and that is referred to as the availability heuristic. The availability heuristic is another way that our brains play tricks on us. When you ask how likely is something to happen, if the image of what we're talking about comes quickly to mind, if, in other words, it's available to us easily, we tend to overestimate how likely that is to happen again. Let me give you one example of this. How likely is it that you will be eaten by that creature or that you will be killed by those creatures? Now, most of us are going to say, well, shark attacks. We hear about shark attacks all the time. That's exactly the problem. In fact, according to statistics, between 2000 and 2009, there were only 9 people who were killed by sharks, but there were 215 killed by horses. So why don't we know that? Well, because that fact is not available to us. It doesn't get in the news. And, you know, we don't tend to read stuff around the dangers of horse riding. You hear stuff about sharks. So the availability heuristic easily distorts stuff with information that comes readily to us. Well, where do we get most of our information? Media. We have TV still, but now we have Twitter and we've got Facebook and Instagram. How much of these are filled with happy, positive, wonderful news? Yeah, how often have you heard a newscast that starts by saying 407 banks in Canada were not robbed today? That the news isn't what catches our attention, and with the proliferation of forms of media, many of us are inundated throughout the day with negative news. And of course, because of the negativity bias and then the availability heuristic, we tend to think everything is gloomy out there. The reality is, in assessing how is the state of the world, we cannot rely upon our intuitions and impressions. We actually must rely upon data and upon statistics. So I'm going to be giving you a big dose of statistics today in order to convince you that, in fact, well, I hope I convince you, that at least in 7 ways, the world is actually getting much better. And I'm not saying let's not pretend that we have significant challenges. Of course we do. But I'm going to conclude with why I think it's so important that we be more focused on the positive than on the negative for the good of the planet. So let's start with number one, violence. Now, again, this is one where it's hard to believe that we are becoming less and less violent as a species. But in fact, the statistics say it's true. Now, part of that is if we go back far enough in history, it becomes very evident. You know, many of us have this image of hunter-gatherer tribes being this very egalitarian, peace-loving kind of people. Well, in fact, in hunter-gatherer days, you know, 20,000 years ago, if you were a male, you had a 50% chance you'd die a violent death. That's actually the reality. And many of us don't realize just how horrible the Middle Ages were. In fact, this is a woodcut done in around 1400. Now, take a look at what's going on in this woodcutting and the number of violent deaths and attacks and images that are being portrayed there. Life in the Middle Ages was horrendous. And we tend not to think about that, but when we look at the global trends, for the last 10,000 years, violence has been declining and declining and declining. But let's bring it more into our age and into the 20th century when we start looking at the details here. The number of wars that have been taking place. Now, the bottom line is interstate wars, and you will see that it's been rather steady and somewhat of a decline, though. And civil wars, more recently, we've seen a sharp decline in the number of civil wars. Of course, the ones that are taking place get in the news. We don't hear about all the ones that aren't happening. But in fact, in terms of sheer numbers, there are less interstate wars and less civil wars than ever. That's good news. When we look at the number of people who die in battles in wars, for population, for every 100,000 people in the population, again, our numbers have declined dramatically over the last 70, 80 years. Less people die in war now. When we look at genocides in the 20th century, again, we see the sharp peak that happened right around World War II with the Nazis and with Japan, and then right after World War II, the mass killings in Russia, or the Soviet Union at the time. But then when we look past World War II, again, we've had this dramatic decline. And of course, when we hear genocide, we think of, well, Rwanda. But what about Rwanda? Well, yes, I'm not saying these aren't horrendous. I'm not saying there isn't work to do. What I am saying is look at the trend. And it's getting more peaceful. When we look at homicide rates in Europe, in a variety of different countries in Europe, homicide rates have declined dramatically over the last 600-700 years. We can look at murder rates in our age in the last 50, 60 years, and the murder rates in the States are declining. The world, it's been harder to track, so we have a shorter period of time to look at, but it is declining. And then for some odd reason, it kind of bumps up in England and Wales. So I don't know. Peter, do you know what that's about? I don't know what that is. But when you actually look at the numbers of what we're talking, the number of people that die in a murder per 100,000 people in England and Wales, it's like one. So again, we've seen this marvelous decline. When we look at issues like rape and sexual assault and violence, victims per 100,000 women, again in the last about 40, 50 years especially, decline. When we look at hate crimes against a wide variety of groups, anti-white, anti-black, anti-Asian, anti-Jewish, anti-Islamic, the numbers all go in the same direction. They are declining. We live in the most peaceful and nonviolent times ever in the history of the planet. When we look at the large picture, when we look at the trends. Now, I also don't want to suggest, by the way, that there's any magic that guarantees that these trends will continue to decline forever. That certainly is not a given, but it certainly suggests that we're moving in the right way here in terms of sheer violence. And again, it's hard to believe sometimes. You know, we had the Summer of the Gun in Toronto. And even this past year, you know, in the States, there was more talks of Summer of the Gun. They didn't use that expression, but it seemed like crime is going everywhere. But in fact, statistically, it's still down. So it's good news. The world is getting better and better in regards to violence overall. A second way that the world is getting better is in regards to poverty. Now, again, there are hundreds of thousands of individuals who live in extreme poverty. and there is much work yet to be done. But look at the trends again. Between 1820 to 2015, there has been a steady and increasing decline, especially in the last 20 or 30 years. We have made so much progress towards the millennial goals set by the United Nations to eradicate extreme poverty. And we are on the way, and people, there are a number of UN specialists who believe that by 2025, we may have eradicated extreme poverty in the world. That's good news. But it's not what you tend to see on the news. In terms of the economic development, lifting people out of poverty, the top line, the red line, represents developing economies. The bottom one, advanced economies. They're outperforming us. In terms of the real incomes that people are gaining. And the developing world, as we're going to see in just a few minutes, is making dramatic, sweeping and fast changes where people are really moving out of poverty. Again, there's lots of work to be done. But boy, we're headed in the right direction. Look at Africa itself, a continent that we often think of in very despairing terms. But you can look, these are just representative sampling, and it may be hard for you to tell, but these are GDP growth rates over the last 10 years in a number of different African countries. And South Africa, the most developed, is the lowest. And some of these are remarkably high. Ethiopia, over the last decade, has had more than a 12% growth in its GDP. And we are seeing Africa is becoming, you know, the place where China and India were 20, 30 years ago, where things are rapidly improving. Now, of course, we have horrible situations going on in some areas of Africa. And recent terrorist attacks there remind us of that. And, of course, we have horrendous situations like in the Congo. But overall, Africa is experiencing an economic revival. One of the big ways that that's happening, by the way, is cell phone technology. Cell phone technology has allowed them to leap past all the limitations that we had when we were stuck with telephones and fax machines. And it's been a marvelous tool for small, single entrepreneurs in Africa to be able to tap into information that allows them to make really smart, effective decisions that allow them to grow and sell and prosper. We can also tie that into, and I am going to tie these two closely together, mortality rates. People are living longer than ever around the world. I mean, here in Canada, at the turn of the 20th century, the average lifespan was about 42, 43 years old. This is why our CPP plan is in such trouble, because we didn't think people were going to live as long as they did when that plan was set up. Now, I want to show you a video by a fellow named Hans Rosling. He is a doctor and statistician from Sweden. He does a lot of consulting to the World Health Organization. He's also a master at presenting information, statistical information, in very easy ways to take in. So this video we're going to look at looks both at poverty and how it's being eradicated, and mortality and how mortality rates are going down and lifespan is going up.
So, here we go. First, an axis for health. Life expectancy. From 25 years to 75 years. And down here, an axis for wealth. Income per person. $400, $4,000, and $40,000. So, down here is poor and sick. And up here is rich and healthy. Now, I'm going to show you the world 200 years ago in 1810. Here come all the countries. Europe brown, Asia red, Middle East green, Africa south of Sahara blue, and the Americas yellow. And the size of the country bubbles show the size of the population. And in 1810, it was pretty crowded down there, wasn't it? All countries were sick and poor. Life expectancy were below 40 in all countries. And only UK and the Netherlands were slightly better off, but not much. And now, why start the world? The Industrial Revolution makes countries in Europe and elsewhere move away from the rest. But the colonized countries in Asia and Africa, they are stuck down there. And eventually, the Western countries get healthier and healthier. And now, we slow down to show the impact of the First World War and the Spanish flu epidemic. What a catastrophe! And now I speed up through the 1920s and the 1930s. And in spite of the Great Depression, Western countries forge on towards greater wealth and health. Japan and some others try to follow, but most countries stay down here. Now, after the tragedies of the Second World War, we stop a bit to look at the world in 1948. 1948 was a great year. The war was over, Sweden topped the medal table at the Winter Olympics, and I was born. But the differences between the countries of the world was wider than ever. United States was in the front, Japan was catching up, Brazil was way behind, Iran was getting a little richer from oil, but still had short lives. And the Asian giants, China, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh and Indonesia, they were still poor and sick down here. But look what is about to happen. Here we go again. In my lifetime, former colonies gained independence, and then finally they started to get healthier and healthier and healthier. And in the 1970s, then countries in Asia and Latin America started to catch up with the Western countries. They became the emerging economies. Some in Africa follows. Some Africans were stuck in civil war and others hit by HIV. And now we can see the world today in the most up-to-date statistics. Most people today live in the middle, but there are huge differences at the same time between the best of countries and the worst of countries. And there are also huge inequalities within countries. These bubbles show country averages, but I can split them. Take China, I can split it into provinces. There goes Shanghai. It has the same wealth and health as Italy today. And there is the poor inland province Guizhou. It is like Pakistan. And if I split it further, the rural parts are like Ghana in Africa. And yet, despite the enormous disparities today, we have seen 200 years of remarkable progress. That huge historical gap between the West and the rest is now closing. We have become an entirely new converging world. And I see a clear trend into the future. With aid, trade, green technology and peace, it's fully possible that everyone can make it to the healthy, wealthy corner.
So poverty is declining. Lifespan is increasing. Health is improving. And there are a number of very specific things that have happened in the last decade. Malaria is being not eradicated, certainly, but greatly reduced. Very simple things, malaria nets. I was just reading recently that meningitis A is almost going to be wiped out in Africa now. In the next year, they think it'll be gone because of new vaccines that have been created that are extremely effective. So we are seeing radical improvements when we look at the big picture overall. Another way that the world is getting better is in terms of human rights. Now, again, we are highly sensitized. I support Amnesty International because it does such phenomenal work in this area. But when we look at the broad picture, again, the world is getting better and better in terms of recognizing basic human rights. Just look at it in terms of the amount of books that are written about the topic of rights of various groups. And when we look over the last approximately 60, 70 years, we can see that the number of books that have been written on these topics grows drastically because it's become an issue that is in the forefront now. Rights tend to prosper in freer societies. And when we look at the number of societies that are moving towards more and more democratic forms of government, more free overall, versus those that are high on an autocracy score, we see this diverging line that there more and more countries are becoming open and democratic. In fact, the Millennium Project says that if you look at the number of actual countries where they are scored as having rated as free, again, this time we want the line going up, and sure enough, it is. When we look at, say, children who are involved in child labor or hazardous jobs, again, just in the last 15 years, we have seen a remarkable decline in the number of children who are forced into child labor. And in fact, if you look at it in the projection into 2020, we will have a remarkable decline continuing. When we look at women's rights in 1912, these were the countries where women had the right to vote. If we jump ahead now to the 1950s, we see a dramatic improvement. And when we look at our era, almost everywhere around the world, women now have the right to vote. Now, that certainly doesn't mean we've achieved full equal rights between women and men. But we see the trend moving in the right direction. Think about gay marriage. In 2000, these are the countries of the world where gay marriage was legal. Now, if we jump ahead, this is where gay marriage is legal. So just in 15 years, we've seen a remarkable improvement in that area. When we look at transgender rights, which is an issue that has now come to the fore much more in the last 2 or 3 years even, in the United States, which is a country that we often feel is not very friendly towards some human rights issues, there are 21 states and the District of Columbia that have laws now that prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. 16 of them also include gender. When we look at gender rights for children in school, these are the red states are the ones where they have legislation protecting their rights both in terms of sexual identity and gender orientation. So we are seeing in the field of human rights more and more progress. That's, sometimes when we hear the news, we read it the wrong way, I think, or we listen to it the wrong way. There's a sense in which you can see that the terrorist attacks in Paris and in Nigeria and in Beirut and in Mali, they catch our attention so much because they are so uncommon. In the Middle Ages, it wouldn't have been that unusual. Now, it wouldn't have been quite the weaponry that we use today, but life has become so much better, and the same in areas of rights. We often hear much about this and transgender rights. Think of that. I guess I can call her my stepdaughter, even though she was 22 years old when Elizabeth and I married. My stepdaughter Taylor is no longer my stepdaughter. She's my stepdaughter's stepson, and has in the last 2 or 3 years become comfortable with her own transgendered identity. In fact, I have to change my language, and I'm getting used to don't say she anymore. And that's one of the issues that, language is changing. So we refer to Taylor now as Z. And this is language that's becoming common. Well, people hear this, and it's kind of like, well, that's so weird. Well, it's weird because these issues are coming to the fore because human rights are becoming more and more accepted as fundamental rights. We're going in the right direction. Business. Now, I hope it don't offend anybody, but I am a diehard capitalist. I believe in the value of business. And it's easier than ever because of what's happening in the world of business. This is a way of evaluating what companies do that has become fairly common in the last 20 years. It's called the triple bottom line, where companies are now evaluated formally in the areas of, are they making money, profit, how they treat their people, and how they impact the planet. There's another category that has developed in the States, and is starting to happen in Canada, but not much yet. There's a third classification now. So you have for-profit companies, you have non-profit organizations, and now there's been this third category recognized that are called for-benefit companies. They are for-profit, but part of their charter, and therefore certain tax privileges that they have, is that they have to use profits and reinvest them back into for the good of the community in which they operate. But they're businesses that are changing the world. In fact, one of the most exciting things I think that's happening is the growth of this movement called conscious capitalism. This was started about 8-9 years ago by John Mackey, who is the founder of Whole Foods, Whole Food Markets, and it has been catching on like wildfire. So let me just show you a short video about conscious capitalism.
Welcome to the virtual home of Conscious Capitalism and the Conscious Capitalism community. Conscious Capitalism is an idea, a movement, an approach to conducting business, and an organization dedicated to advancing all of these. Conscious Capitalism comes to life as it's applied to business, nonprofits, and other organizations. It's about more than business as it advances the power of business to serve humanity. Four core principles guide a conscious business or other organization that practices conscious capitalism. These four principles, higher purpose, a stakeholder orientation, conscious leadership, and conscious culture, support entrepreneurs and business leaders to create value for all, building trust and creating healthy, resilient, sustainable businesses. You can learn more about these principles in the sections of the site dedicated to each of them, and more about conscious capitalism in general throughout the site. Conscious Capitalism Incorporated is a nonprofit organization dedicated to cultivating the theory and practice of conscious capitalism. We offer transformative thinking, programs, events, and communities of inquiry designed to support the elevation of humanity. We invite you to visit the Engage section of the site, sign up as a member, create your online profile, and participate in conversations. We encourage you to connect with your peers here to form learning communities, and we invite you to participate in our events and other activities. Thank you for joining the conversation, the community, and the movement.
The Conscious Capitalism runs a conference every spring in Chicago. This year, it's going to be April 12th to 14th, if any of you want to come along. I attended my first last year. It was an amazing experience to be with over 500 business owners who are committed to using their business to transform the world for good. And these are not just small kinds of businesses. They are major corporations now. I was speaking with, or I went to a seminar with the CEO or COO, I forget, of Hyatt, the hotel chain. And it's fascinating to see what they have committed to do in the next decade to become like fully sustainable organizations. It's exciting. There's a big box, like literally box container store, I think that's what it's called, if I remember right, the container store in the States, which is massive, and it sells boxes. And we got to hear the CEO talk about his challenge and when they went public. And all of a sudden you become responsible to shareholders, and part of what they did was, you know, they stayed this very firm line on we will not stray from our conscious capitalism principles. And there was a study recently done that showed that the companies that are part of this movement are fabulously more profitable than others. And that's part of what excites Elizabeth, my wife, and I. We, since the last time I was here, when Elizabeth spoke with me, Elizabeth at the time was working for the CBC. She used to run her own consulting business, and then she went to work for the CBC for a couple of years, left just around the Gian Gomeshi thing. She didn't have anything to do with that, but she left at that time. And kind of wondered, was she going to go back into business for herself? Was she going to go back into a job? And in February, we decided, let's go into business together. So we are now together as partners running a consulting firm. We call that firm Blue Dot Strategy, taken from the name of the reading by Carl Sagan that you saw. And we are firm believers that business has perhaps the greatest potential power to transform the world for good, even more than governments do. And we're part of this growing movement of people who are committed to business transforming the world. Another way that the world is changing, and in my perspective, it's a change for the better, is the growth of veganism. Now, this is my one missionary moment and my evangelical appeal during the talk, but veganism is growing, and here's why. I'm going to tell you in a bit why I think that's so good for the planet, but, you know, there's been a lot of recent information about the ways that veganism has become more and more common, number of articles that are being written about this trend. And even in China, where traditionally there wasn't even a word, we were over in China a couple of years ago, and there wasn't even a real word for vegetarian, let alone vegan. If you're not familiar with the difference, vegan, it's like no animal products whatsoever, including milk, eggs, etc. We look at the Google searches between vegetarianism and veganism, and there's a lot more people searching around veganism than there is around just vegetarianism. So why do I include this in this talk? Well, because it's good for the world, I think, in three specific ways. Number one, it's compassionate for animals. And if any of you are aware of animal business and horrific practices that are permitted there that would never be permitted with other animals, it's good for animals when people stop eating them and wearing them and using them for entertainment. Second, it's way better for health. And even more recently, you know, you've probably heard the report that came out that was linking the eating of white meat with cancer. Well, this isn't news. And there's a lot of other studies that show the amazing health benefits of a vegan diet. And third, it's way better for the environment. In fact, the United Nations, back in 2006, published a report that was called The Long Shadow of Agriculture, in which it identified a number of things, but agriculture as it's currently practiced is the biggest source of CO2, greenhouse gas. Animal agriculture is also extremely intensive on resources. We can grow 10 times the amount of wheat than what it takes to feed a cow to get 1 pound of meat. So if we're worried about the food shortages in the world, one great way to reduce the environment, impact on the environment, and to make sure that we have enough to feed everybody is to go vegan. So there you go. That also does tie into my last way that I want to talk about, is the environment. Now, I recognize that, you know, the planet is still warming up, so I'm not saying we've turned the corner on that. But our attempts to combat and mitigate the impact of climate change and global warming is getting better and better and better.
Weather has wrought havoc all over
it's
the world.
It's happening here and now.
We are running out of
damage by the water.
So there's been a lot of news about climate change. A lot of bad news, that is. And for the good news?
Right.
Well, there hasn't really been any. Until recently. Today we're facing the hard truth of climate change with the stubborn relentlessness of human will. And good news is happening.
Right. And now for some good news.
Every day, new solutions are emerging. And not just wouldn't it be neat if solutions, real solutions. Our ability to convert sunshine into usable energy is rapidly becoming more advanced and accessible. Which is great, because every hour the sun is sending enough raw energy to Earth to meet the entire world's energy demands for a full year. And the cost for clean energy technologies is dropping. Right now, the cost of solar energy is equal to or cheaper than fossil fuel energy in about 79 countries.
I didn't even know there were 79 countries.
And the electric car market is booming thanks to falling battery prices. And guess who likes that?
Who?
All types of people from around the world are starting to embrace renewable solutions. Schools are being powered by clean energy. Financial institutions are realizing dirty energy is a bad investment. And businesses are finding that going green is good for the bottom line. Which leads us to more good news. These solutions are actually working. It turns out that what is good for the environment is also good for the economy in many ways, like reducing poverty, spurring innovation, and creating jobs. In 2013, nearly 6.5 million people were employed globally by the renewable energy industry.
Job creation. Brilliant.
Right. And while other industries are shrinking, renewables are growing as new technologies and capabilities are being rapidly discovered.
And here's some more great news.
This groundswell of support for renewable energy is forcing leaders and governments to take action. The two biggest carbon emitters, China and the US, have made moves to curb their carbon pollution and invest in cleaner energy technologies. And they're not alone. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is convening nations to forge a climate treaty that could unify the world to work together and lower our carbon emissions, transitioning us to a global clean energy society. We all know the bad news. Climate change is here. It's big, it's bad, and it's hurting us and our economies. But the important thing to know is that there is also good news. We have solutions here today. Not dreams or wishes, real world solutions that are ready to go and that are already saving money and improving lives.
Everyone's a winner.
If we rally around this good news and embrace solutions, we can forge the path to a clean energy future and make sure that progress is our new reality.
That's good news. Thank you for watching.
One of the countries that was mentioned in this is China. Now, China currently is the largest polluter and the largest contributor to CO2 gases. But one of my very favorite sources of news is Mother Jones. It's a nice left-leaning kind of source for my news. This article appeared back in June, and I just want to read a little bit for you. This might sound crazy, but we have some good news about the planet. That's interesting that that's how they start, right? This might sound crazy, but we have some good news about the planet. China has long exerted an outsized role in global climate change, not simply because it's by far the world's leading emitter of greenhouse gas, due largely to its enormous population, its rapid growth, and its reliance on dirty coal, but also because of China's influence over global politics as a holdout in international climate deals. Now, the reigning heavyweight contributor to global warming might be slimming down. China's greenhouse gas emissions are likely to peak and then to begin to taper around 2025, according to a new report. That's 5 years ahead of a promise made by China's leader as part of China's historic climate accord with the United States. The new analysis, released Monday by the London School of Economics, says China's emissions could peak even earlier than that and begin to fall rapidly thereafter, holding out a tantalizing possibility. The world could stay within the internationally agreed-upon limit of 2 degrees Celsius, warming above pre-industrial levels, according to the authors. That limit is seen by scientists as a crucial threshold to stay within to prevent some of the most dangerous impacts of climate change. Good news. And there are interesting things happening around the world. Wind now competes with fossil fuels in terms of prices, and solar is almost there. The UK, interestingly, is testing roads that recharge your electric car as you drive on them. The Dutch have solar panel bike lanes that are working phenomenally well. I'm not powering the bike, your legs do that, but they are absorbing solar power that then is fed back to the grid. There are awesome technological advances that are happening all around us. If you want to read a really cool book around this, Bill Nye, the science guy, has a brand new book out called Unstoppable, which is looking at a myriad of ways that we have the opportunity now, with technology that exists now, to turn the corner. If you want to read an even more exciting book, this is one of the best books I've read in a decade called Abundance. And it is a massive antidote to pessimism. And again, it looks at stuff that I had never heard of that's happening around the world in many of these different areas, not just global warming. There is good stuff happening. Now, some of you are familiar with the monk debates that happen usually about monthly in Toronto, and they do all kinds of fascinating topics. In our last election, they had the political leaders at one of these. After I decided on this topic, it was very fortuitous that the last monk debate, actually, the question was, be it resolved, humankind's best days lie ahead. And, you know, I have two speakers on pro and two speakers con on that. Well, I want to let you listen to just a little bit of one of the speakers. Matt Ridley is one of my favorite science writers. He's from Great Britain, and his book back in 2007 or 2008 called Rational Optimist, again, looked at statistically what is actually happening in the world. And I want you to listen just to a little bit of his argument during that debate.
Woody Allen once said, more than at any time in history, mankind faces a crossroads. One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction. Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose wisely. And that's the way pretty well everybody talks about the future. When I was young, the future was especially grim. The population explosion was unstoppable, famine was inevitable, pesticides were giving us cancer, the deserts were advancing, the oil was running out, the rainforests were doomed, acid rain, bird flu, and the hole in the ozone layer were going to make us sick, my sperm count was falling, and a nuclear winter would finish us off. You probably think I'm exaggerating. Well, here's what a best-selling book by the economist Robert Heilbronner concluded. In the year I left school, the outlook for man, I believe, is painful, difficult, perhaps desperate, and the hope that can be held out for his future prospects seem to be very slim indeed. It was only a decade or two later that it dawned on me that every one of these threats had either been a false alarm or had been greatly exaggerated. The dreadful future was not as bad as the grown-ups had told me it would be. Life just kept on getting better and better for the vast majority of people. The human lifespan has been growing at the rate of 5 hours a day for 50 years. The greatest measure of misery anybody can think of, child mortality, has gone down by two-thirds in that time. Malaria mortality is down by an amazing 60% in 15 years. Oil spills in the ocean are down by 90% since the 1970s. An object the size of a slice of bread lets you send letters, have conversations, watch movies, find your way around, take pictures, and tell hundreds of people what you had for breakfast. And what's getting worse? Traffic, obesity, problems of abundance, note. Here's a funny thing. Most improvements are gradual, so they don't make the news. Bad news tends to come suddenly. Car crashes make the news. Falling child mortality doesn't. And as Steve says, every year the average person on the planet grows wealthier, healthier, happier, cleverer, cleaner, kinder, freer, safer, more peaceful, and more equal. More equal? Yes. Global inequality is on the way down, and fast. Why? Because people in poor countries are getting rich faster than people in rich countries. Africa is experiencing an astonishing economic miracle these days, a bit like Asia did a decade or two ago. Mozambique is 60% richer per capita than it was in 2008. Ethiopia's economy is growing at about 10% a year. The world economy has shrunk in only 1 year since the Second World War. In 2009, when it dipped by less than 1% before growing 5% the next year. If anything, the march of prosperity is speeding up. But my optimism about the future isn't based on extrapolating the past. It's based on why these things are happening. Innovation, driven by the meeting and mating of ideas to produce baby ideas, is the fuel that drives them. And far from running out of fuel, we're only just getting started. There's an infinity of ways of recombining ideas to make new ideas. And we no longer have to rely on North Americans and Europeans to come up with them. The internet has speeded up at the rate at which people can communicate and cross-fertilize their ideas. Take vaping. In my country, there are more than 4 million people who've pretty well given up smoking because of e-cigarettes. It's proving to be the best aid to quitting we've ever come up with. It's probably about as safe as coffee. And it was invented in China by a man named Hon Lik, who combined a bit of chemistry with a bit of electronics. And we're all benefiting from that. So today, inventions are happening everywhere, and we're benefiting from them. But isn't all this progress coming at the expense of the environment? Well, no, often the reverse. Many environmental indicators are improving in many countries. More forest, more wildlife, cleaner air, cleaner water. Even the extinction rates coming down compared with 100 years ago for the creatures we know most about, birds and mammals, thanks to the efforts of conservationists. And the richer countries are, the more likely their environment's improving. The biggest environmental problems are in poor countries. But what about population? The population growth rate of the world has halved in my lifetime from 2% to 1%, and the birth rate's plummeting in Africa today. The world population quadrupled in the 20th century, but it's not even going to double in the 21st, and the UN thinks it'll stop growing altogether by the 2080s. Not because of war, pestilence, and famine, as gloomy old Parson Malthus feared, but because of prosperity, education, and health. There's a simple and beautiful fact about demography. When more children survive, people plan smaller families. With slowing population growth and expanding farm yields, it's getting easier and easier to feed the world. Today, it takes 68% less land to grow the same amount of food as 50 years ago. That means more land for nature. In theory, you can feed the world from a hydroponic farm the size of Ontario and keep the rest for wildlife. And the planet's getting greener. Satellites have recorded 14% more green vegetation than 30 years ago, especially in arid areas like the Sahel region of Africa. But am I like the man who falls out of the skyscraper and as he passes the second floor shouts out, "So far, so good"? I don't think so. You'll probably hear the phrase turning point in this debate. You'll be told that this generation is the one that's going to be worse off than its parents, that it's going to die younger or see sudden deterioration in the environment. Well, let me tell you about turning points. Every generation thinks it stands at a turning point, that the past is fine but the future's bleak. As Lord Macaulay put it in 1830, in every age, everybody knows that up to his own time, progressive improvement has been taking place. Nobody seems to reckon on any improvement in the next generation. We cannot absolutely prove that those are in error who say society has reached a turning point, that we have seen our best days. But so said all who came before us, and with just as much apparent reason. We filter the past for happy memories and filter the future for gloomy prognoses. It's a strange form of narcissism. We have to believe that our generation's the special one where the turning point comes. And I'm afraid it's nonsense. Macaulay again, to end. On what principle is it that with nothing but improvement behind us, we are to expect nothing but deterioration before us?
So why did I choose to focus on this topic? Well, two reasons, I think. Number one, despair motivates in the short run, but not in the long run. It's tiring to always feel heavy, that things are just horrible out there. But in fact, the reality is in many areas, things are getting better and better. So I hope this is simply a shot in the arm in terms of a little bit of vaccination against despair. But the bigger reason why I wanted to focus on this is to ask the question, now that you've seen all these different ways that the world is improving, why is that happening? Now, I don't believe that there's any, you know, cause force that is bringing this inevitable evolution to our planet, that everything is going to turn into a utopia. Things have gotten better and better because humans are making it better and better. That's the main point I want to leave with you, is our actions make a difference. It's easy to think there's nothing we can do when, in fact, what we do makes a difference. Whether it's individually or collectively, through government, through business, it's humans that are making the world better and better in at least the ways that I've talked about this morning. So I'm not saying become complacent. I'm not saying take your foot off the gas. What I am saying is we are headed in the right direction. Thank you. Do you want me to do those, or do you want to do those? Okay, that's fine.
Thank you, Scott, so much. We are privileged to have such an interesting and encouraging and information data-driven presentation this morning, and to help us combat our natural inclinations for the negative. So I don't know how many of you grew up in an evangelical church, but I grew up hearing about the importance of sharing the good news, which was the gospel of Jesus Christ. So this really puts a new spin on sharing the good news. So I invite you to stand and... just before we sing one last time, my charge to you this morning is to take what you've heard and use it to energize yourselves and to encourage others and to stay positive. Go and share the good news. Go in peace.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.